All right, we're in Deuteronomy chapter 22 and we're about halfway through. And we're coming to, I guess we're continuing with the case law of the book of Deuteronomy. And in particular, we are continuing on with the section that deals with boundaries in life. And today we're going to be looking at boundaries around sexual relationships. And I guess one of the things that we want to keep in mind as we're looking at the law of God is the temptation to impose our own sense of morality and our own moral structures onto the law of God rather than allowing the law of God to direct our sense of morality. We want to make sure we approach it the right way round. It says in Psalm 19 and verse 7 that the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is your servant warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Declare me innocent from hidden faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. It also says in Proverbs 28 verse 4 that those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law strive against them. Evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand it completely. And so there's a tendency for us all to sit in judgment over the law, but we've got it the wrong way around, because the law sits in judgment of us. And when we take our cultural morality and impose it onto the law of God, we do the law a disservice, and in fact we practice what it says in Proverbs there, that when we forsake the law we praise the wicked, which is not what we want to be doing as the church of the Lord Jesus. And those who keep the law strive against the wicked. And while evil men do not understand justice, those who seek the Lord understand it completely. In Romans 8, it says, the mindset on the flesh is death, but the mindset on the spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, for it does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. And those who are in the flesh cannot please God. And so if we find that the law of God offends us, the problem isn't with the law, it's with us. And we ought to go to the Lord and seek his wisdom and his counsel in terms of why this is so offensive to us. So let's get into Deuteronomy 22. And we're up to verse 13. It says, if any man takes a wife and goes into her and then hates her and accuses her of misconduct and brings a bad name upon her, saying, I took this woman, and when I came near her, I did not find in her evidence of virginity, then the father of the young woman and her mother shall take and bring out the evidence of her virginity to the elders of the city gate. And the father of the young woman shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man to marry, and he hates her. And behold, he has accused her of misconduct, saying, I did not find in your daughter evidence of virginity. And yet this is the evidence of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the cloak before the elders of the city. Then the elders of that city shall take the man and whip him, and they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought a bad name upon a virgin of Israel, and she shall be his wife. He may not divorce her all his days. But if the thing is true that evidence of virginity was not found in the young woman, then they shall not bring out, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of the father's house, and the men of the city shall stone her to death with stones because she has done an outrageous thing in Israel by whoring in her father's house. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. Okay. So the example of case law is given here to prevent unjust accusations in marriage. So it's unlawful for a husband to accuse his wife of unfaithfulness in order to divorce her. Now, so understanding that the context is that he's not accusing her of unfaithfulness because she's been unfaithful. He's accusing her of unfaithfulness so that he can get an easy out of the marriage that he wasn't happy with. And the law says this should not happen. And if the husband can't produce evidence of what he's saying, then he is to pay double the bride price to the bride's family for the insult, and that he's also to be scourged to ensure that the message is clear. It's as we see in chapter 24, the law actually allows for divorce, and there's no need for a husband to defame his wife with false accusations in order to divorce her. And so upon the accusation, there are two things that happen. First of all, the parents of the bride are given opportunity to bring evidence of her virginity, and he also must be able to prove his accusation to be true. And so what we see in the law is that while on the surface it sort of appears a bit odd to us, it's actually to maintain justice in the mess of life that surrounds broken marriages. It's the role of, the reason that it's such an offence is because it's the role of a husband to protect his wife, and for a husband to seek to expose his wife unjustly is a betrayal of his role as the husband. And that ought not to happen in Israel or in God's kingdom. Verse 22 says, if a man is found lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die. The man who lay with the woman and the woman, so you shall purge the evil from Israel. Now, perhaps before we go too much further, we need to understand that marriage is a foundational institution of society for a number of reasons. And the Bible treats marriage very seriously. The seventh commandment is you shall not commit adultery. As we've talked about, when the law forbids something, the contrary obligation is applied. So if we're not to commit adultery, it means that we are to hold marriage in high esteem and to honour marriage. And the reason is, there's a number of reasons actually. First of all, it's not good for man to be alone. So God has given us marriage as a grace because it's not good for us to be alone. And for those of us who are married or have been married, I hope you find that your wife is a grace to you. I really don't like to think for too long on the type of person I would be if I didn't marry Gail and she hadn't brought some correction and direction to my life. She was a grace to me and very grateful for that. Yeah. Yes. Everyone's grateful. Because it's not good for us to not have that word, that wisdom in our ear to keep us on the straight and narrow. Also, marriage is important as a covering for our nakedness. So it sets up a boundary for sexual activity. So, which is good within the protection of marriage between one man and one woman to the exclusion of all of others, but it's destructive when it's practiced outside of those boundaries. Moving on from that, it's also the proper setting within which procreation can occur. So, for a number of reasons. First of all, when procreation occurs within a marriage, the children will have male and female role models to bring them up in the fear of the Lord. Now, as I'm sort of talking through these issues of marriage, and I've said, you know, this a number of times as I've talked about marriage, I understand life is complicated. And there are times when, families come into existence without both a mother and father, and sometimes that can happen for a variety of reasons. And there are many single parents who do a fantastic job with their kids, and I'm not suggesting that that's not the case. What I am saying is that in God's plan for marriage, the ideal is that children would have a father and a mother living in the home with them, so that they have those role models to be able to grow up with. It's a tough job when either a father or a mother has to bring the kids up on their own, because then they have to be both elements to the child, and that is a tough call. And I'm not playing that down. I understand life is complex. We're talking about ideals here. Secondly, it's important because children should know their heritage. It's important that kids know where they come from, that they have a sense of identity and a sense of place. That's important for a strong and healthy culture. And it's also important because then inheritance is clearly defined. Okay, that there aren't squabbles over inheritance. And what we'll see is that for God, heritage is important and inheritance is important. That the blessings that are accumulated within a household are correctly passed on to the next generation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of marriage, like whether, yeah, so if there's a male and a female who are residing together, yep, and raising children, yeah, okay. And so the distinction is that when you have marriage, you have a man and a woman who are covenanted together, as opposed to cohabitating. Now, the covenant is a strong promise to one another that they're going to work together and are committed to one another for the rest of their days. Now, obviously, the introduction of no-fault divorce has watered that down significantly. Jesus was clear when the Pharisees were asking him about questions of divorce that divorce is not God's plan. It never was. However, understanding that we are sinful, God has allowed for divorce so that we don't kill one another. Who is that guy on YouTube, the commentator, Michael Knowles? He's Italian by background, and so there's only one way his marriage could end before they die, and that is that his wife would take him out, because they've decided they're never going to divorce. And so he's but it's that notion that when we marry one another, the commitment is lifelong, and it's a serious commitment, and that provides great stability to the home, whereas when that commitment isn't made, the the Bible, in terms of God's counsel, is that the benefits of marriage ought not to be taken outside of that binding commitment to one another. Because it's not right for a man to seek the benefits of marriage from a woman without committing himself to her to protect her and provide for her. It puts her in a vulnerable position that she ought not to be placed into. And it's not right for a woman to take advantage of the benefits of marriage from a man without that commitment to him, because it's a similar abuse. It's in effect, it's a form of theft, because you're taking from someone what doesn't belong to you, and potentially taking from someone else what does belong to them, because if things break up and they go and get married elsewhere, then the husband or wife has been stolen from, if that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. And look, I'm aware that the reason I prefaced what I'm saying with what I said is that we live in a culture that doesn't take marriage seriously at all. But God takes it extremely seriously. And if we're serious about God, then we'll be serious about marriage. See, God's plan is that society, and this is the next reason for marriage, will be firmly established on the committed and intimate union within a family. That the family's the place from which loyalty and submission and self-sacrifice are learned, and those character qualities will flow into a flourishing society. But outside of that, if we have homes where where men and women aren't committed to one another, where are the children going to learn commitment? If they don't see examples of self-sacrifice and of mutual submission, how is that going to flow into society? There's people are going to be living for themselves, because that's what they see within the homes, or they're going to be living in a guarded way where they only give away certain aspects of themselves and not be willing to do so wholly. And also, marriage is given so that the world would see God's plan for his son to make for himself a bride, and that is the church. And so as God's laying out the foundations for the society that the Israelites are to live out, so that they can be a light to the nations, marriage is at the centre of it, because God has married himself to the nation of Israel. He's entered into a marriage covenant with the nation to say that I'm committing myself to you, and I'm asking you to commit yourself to me in faithfulness. And because Israel was unfaithful, God consistently sent warnings to the nation to say, turn back to me so that I can forgive you. But as they continued to reject him, he eventually divorced the nation of Israel. And we see the fruit of that in the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And he also has established for himself a bride, that is the church, that is his faithful bride. And it says in Hebrews that this is the Rachel and the Leah story, that the nation of Israel was like Leah and the church is like Rachel, that he sort of woke up on his wedding morning with the bride that he wasn't looking for. And so he worked that through, and also at this, you know, the story how... 7 years. That's right. He worked 7 years for Rachel, and so marriage is at the center of what the church is about. It's at the center of God's plan for the earth. Yep.
Yeah. restore a marriage.
Yep.
And he's done that.
Mm.
So as we walk with him and honour him, he will restore any brokenness in our marriages or anything that's causing havoc. So we just got to trust him.
And it's one of those things, as far as it depends upon me sort of thing, because there's two parties involved. So it's not always going to work out that way, but it drastically improves the chances that it will work. Yeah. What was I going to say to that? When we enter into marriage counselling with people that are wanting to get married, our first sort of call is to say, look, if Christ is not at the centre of your marriage, you're going to make work hard for yourself, because he's what marriage is all about, and it flows out of who he is. And so when he's at the centre, a lot of other things fall into line. And it's not going to say everything's going to be easy, because marriage can be hard work, but it's well worth it. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Yep. Now, the thing about marriage too is that it's a relationship that has the potential for the most incredible blessing and benefit to those that are married. And because it is as a relationship with such potential, it also can, when things go wrong, it can be the most hurtful and disappointing thing that you can experience. As I'm sharing this stuff, please understand that when God understands that he's working with fallen, broken people. Yep. Okay, and so his grace allows for things that he ought not have had to allow for, but because of our nature, he has in his goodness. Yeah, and that for those who have experienced hurt in relationships, particularly when they're sexual relationships, that there is grace and forgiveness and restoration available in Christ, that he's a gracious God. And so please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But what the law is trying to do is establish a norm for society. Okay? And it's saying that, look, you know, marriage is important and it's not to be abused in the ways that we're about to cover. Because if those abuses are allowed to continue, it's going to lead to the downfall of a culture. Proverbs 18:22 says, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favour from the Lord." And so when God talks about the nation of Israel, he calls Israel an adulterous wife because of the nation's unfaithfulness towards him. And so it's a picture that's at the very center of that relationship. And in fact, he says that the way that we treat our husbands or wives is a reflection of our attitude towards him. In Malachi chapter 2, God's the people of Israel have gone to God and said, "What's happened? Why are we not being blessed?" And God says, well, here's some reasons. And verse 13, he says, "And this second thing you do, you cover the Lord's altar with tears, with weeping and groaning, because he no longer regards the offering or accepts it with favour from your hand. But you say, why does he not? Because the Lord has witnessed between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Did he not make them one with a portion of the Spirit in their union? And what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring. So guard yourselves in your spirit, and let none of you be faithless to the wife of your youth. For For the man who does not love his wife but divorces her, says the Lord, the God of Israel, covers his garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. So guard yourselves in your spirit and do not be faithless. So that's pretty serious, isn't it? And we ought to take it seriously. Because when marriage is undermined, society is thrown into chaos. And that's why, if you ever take the time to read the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Joseph Engels, one of the things that they want to destroy is family. Because family establishes inheritance and property ownership. And so the desire of the communists is to dismantle family, and one of the strategies to do that is by removing the concept of womanhood, because the mother is the sort of centre of the home. And so by removing the concept of womanhood, it dismantles the family, which then dismantles the idea of property ownership, which in their mind would then make us all equal. But God is very interested in property ownership. In fact, most of what is written in the scriptures is around property ownership and inheritance and so on. In fact, the language of our salvation is one of inheritance. And the reason for that is that if the government, in its desire to establish its power, removes private property ownership, then what do we really have to work for and to fight for and to live for? Not that property's everything, but the reason we go out to work and are productive citizens is because of our capacity to own private property and to care for that private property and protect it. And the reason we desire to establish private property is so that we can provide for our children. And that our children may inherit the fruit of our labour while we're on the earth. And our children's children, absolutely, yeah. And God's interested in the generations. He's interested in the legacy that we leave behind. Because those things establish security within culture and stability. It's the motivation to go out and work. It's the motivation to be productive in society. It's the motivation to establish a good reputation. It's a whole heap in society that that we have lived in the shadow of its benefit for a long time, that's been established and is being eroded by the contemporary sort of mindset that seeks to disregard God's law. And when we do that, we love wickedness, as it says in Proverbs.
Yep. Something on TV the other night, and they interviewed a whole heap of young children and young teenagers, and they were showing that the depression rate and anxiety rate has gone up so high because they have no focus of what the future is going to give them. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Sit there and listen to these boys and girls that say we have no future.
Yep.
That's how they look at it.
Yeah.
But that's what the world's doing. It's taking that away from them.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And, we're sort of the notion that we can be sexually independent and, serve our desires without any consequence, it's leaving society miserable because in my experience, probably because my children are about that age, I hear more and more young women in particular bemoaning the fact that they can't find a husband who's going to do what who's going to fulfil their desires in the sense of being a protector and a provider and faithful and, because they've been teaching men to just go out and live for themselves, and that they're not needed in the home, they're not wanted in, you know, and it's essentially creating broad-scale depression and anxiety and all sorts of issues, which I won't go into because we'll be here for days. But I hope, as inadequately as I'm communicating these things, we need to understand that healthy marriages are the bedrock of a healthy society. And if nothing else, the church ought to be a light to the nations by saying, see how you can flourish when your household is in order, when your marriage is healthy and committed and faithful, and see the benefit that it causes for your children and for your, you know, for your future, that the way that it changes and transforms society. And, you know, because one of the big beefs that people have with the law of God is, why is God so uptight about all this marriage stuff? But that's because they don't understand what God is doing in all of that. And all of that flows out of the fact that God is a, in himself, desires for his son to be married. That the father desired for his son to be married, so he prepared a bride for her He prepared a bride for him, that's right, before the foundation of the earth, that he would lay down his life for. And he would provide for and protect and, you know, and nurture and, there's a lot in it. So we go to verse 23. It says, if there is a betrothed virgin and a man meets her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of the city and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry for help, though she was in the city, and the man, because he violated his neighbor's wife. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. But if in the open country a man meets a young woman who is betrothed, and the man seizes and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the young woman who has committed no offence punishable by death. For this case is like that of a man attacking and murdering his neighbour because he met her in the open country, and though the betrothed young woman cried for help, there was no one to rescue her. Now, we've got to understand cities are different in that time than they are now. So we think of cities, they're places where people can go and shut doors and lock windows and you can't hear what's going on inside. Okay, the cities, I don't think glass was really a thing in ancient Israel. Is that right, Matt? Glaziers? Yeah. So you couldn't actually shut your window. You could close them up with wooden sort of shutters, I suppose. Yeah, but the houses were also very close. People didn't have TVs and radios blaring all day. You could hear what your neighbours were doing fairly easily. And so if there was a struggle and the woman was resisting, people would have heard it. And so the law says if this happens, the man should be stoned, the woman shouldn't be. But if she didn't cry out, if she didn't make a struggle, even if she says later on that he forced himself on me, she's still guilty because she didn't cry out at the time. Okay? Which is... you know, you sort of hear of stuff going on today where women, with the whole sort of Me Too movement kind of thing happening, where, you know, they tried to force this idea that every woman should be believed. And I'm not saying that women shouldn't be believed. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying here. But at the same time, there were a group of women who would see a male with some financial resources, and so they would go and pretend to be their friend and do things that they ought not to have been doing, but they decided to do, and then later go and say that they had forced themselves on them. And, you know, I've heard text messages, or I've seen text messages that this woman was sending to another saying, oh, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get him to do this, and then I can go away with some marks to show that, you know, and complain. Which is unjust, because for women who are genuinely attacked, then it makes it hard for them to be believed, which should not happen. And so this law is an attempt to try and sort that business out. And as I said, it's case law, so it's there for the principle so that we can apply that in other settings. That, that there needs to be, it prevents a woman from participating in consensual fornication and later saying that she was forced upon. All right, verse 28 says, if a man meets a virgin who is not betrothed and seizes her and lies with her and are found, then the man who lay with her shall give to the father of the young woman 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he has violated her, and he may not divorce her all his days. So where a man takes an unbetrothed virgin, as in the case of Amnon and Tamar, you may sort of remember that, 2 Samuel chapter 13, where David's son took advantage of his sister. He's obligated to marry her and to pay the full bride price to the father, and he would not be allowed to divorce her for all of her days. Now, it doesn't say that the bride has to accept the invitation to marry, but understanding the culture of the day, if you were a woman who had been violated, it would be very hard to find another husband. So it's actually a protection for the woman, for the man to marry her. And verse 30, a man shall not take his father's wife, so that he does not uncover his father's nakedness. Leviticus 18 goes into great detail about the depravity of uncovering the nakedness of close relatives, including relatives by marriage. So, what we need to understand is that God does take adultery and fornication very seriously. And that's confirmed in the New Testament, where it says that neither adulterers nor fornicators will inherit the kingdom of God. Because can you understand how important marriage is to God, and how important the containing of sexual union to within the boundaries of marriage is? It's foundational to a healthy, flourishing society, and it's also foundational to healthy and flourishing individuals. In John 8, chapter 3, we see the story of the woman caught in adultery, and the Pharisees bring her out to Jesus to say, well, what are you going to do? She was caught in the very act. Now, what we see here is an unlawful use of the law, because if she was caught in the act, where is the man who was part of that act? So it was unlawful for them to bring the woman only and not the man. And Jesus bends down and writes on the ground. Now, what was he writing? No idea. The Pharisee's sin, listing them off. Yep. It's maybe writing the Ten Commandments. Maybe, who knows. But Jesus' response is, well, if you're without sin, cast the first stone. And when they all went away, from the oldest first to the youngest, Jesus' response to her was, well, where are your accusers? She said, there are none. And his response is, well, go and sin no more. Okay. He didn't ignore it and say it wasn't sin. He said, I'm not here to condemn you, but you need to stop what you're doing, because things won't go well for you. God takes it seriously, and we're in a time of grace. Okay. He's patient with us, and he's waiting for us to return to him, but there's going to come a day when time will be up, and then it'll be time for judgment. Then Jesus will be here to judge us, but for now he's not. He's here to lead us to himself. The law is given to us to judge us, so that we can judge ourselves and we can recognize our need for the mercy of Christ and the grace of Christ. And we also need to recognize that none of us is without sin. And so when we look at the mess of society today, because the boundaries of marriage have been eroded, we need to understand that we're not in a position to cast stones. It's our role to inspire to bring about change. Okay. And we do that by being the light to the nations, by offering words of wisdom where they're needed, encouraging people to make right choices and enacting laws that support healthy and strong marriages. Because adultery, after all, is a description of our unfaithfulness towards God. It's a sin of which we're all guilty, and yet Jesus, our faithful bridegroom, bore the penalty for our sin. He was scourged for our offence, and he was put to death because of our unfaithfulness, and he graciously receives us into his household as his bride, even though we've offended him. And that's an amazing thing.